Thank you. You may be seated. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Richard Chambers Courthouse here in Pasadena. This is the time set for oral argument in the case of Todd Yukitaki, David Kikua, versus Ann Lopez in her official capacity as the Attorney General of the State of Hawaii and the City and County of Honolulu. If counsel are ready to proceed, you may come forward.
Joanne Sager on behalf of the State of Hawaii. May it please the court. This case is about two administrative details of Hawaii's shall issue licensing regime for acquisition of firearms: the handgun permit validity period and the inspection requirement for guns not purchased from licensed dealers. These administrative details, much like the rest of the shall issue licensing regime, are presumptively constitutional under Bruin and Heller. To rebut that presumption, those same precedents required the plaintiffs to show that these provisions have been put to abusive ends, or, in this court's terminology, that they functioned as a meaningful constraint on the right to keep and bear arms. The plaintiffs here have not made that showing. As Judge Bea noted in dissent from the panel opinion, the plaintiffs have offered no evidence and have made no claims that either the permit validity period or the inspection requirement prevented them from keeping and bearing arms. 30 days is plenty of time to pick up a gun that you've purchased, and that permit validity period ensures that the purchaser's criminal history and mental health status, which are indisputably permissible conditions on the acquisition of firearm, are current. Likewise, it's no great burden to bring a 3D-printed gun to the police station for inspection. And that inspection requirement ensures that there's a serial number on the firearm, just like there would be on any firearm purchased from a licensed dealer. For that reason, plaintiff's challenge fails.
Okay, I'll ask a question. So meaningful constraint, you seem to kind of, you mentioned meaningful constraint, but as I understand meaningful constraint, that comes up at what we would, I guess, sometimes call prong one of Bruin. So your position, I guess, is that this doesn't even implicate the Second Amendment at all. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think we haven't reached that point. And as Bruin explained, there's an initial plain text analysis in which you're supposed to analyze whether the Second Amendment right is implicated by examining the text of the statute and the text of the Second Amendment. And
so let's do that.
Sure.
Because the Second Amendment, as you know, says it shall not be infringed. Where does meaningful constraint? I understand we have case law that applies meaningful constraint there, but where does meaningful constraint fit within that textual analysis of shall not infringe?
We'd say it's the third step of what the court had explained in the plain text analysis. First, you look at whether it's one of the people that's covered. Then you look at whether the arms are in common use. Then you look at the
counsel,
proposed.
I'm having trouble hearing you a little bit. Can I get you to lean in a little?
Oh, sure, sure. So as Bruin explained, there are three things that you analyze when you're looking at the text. You look at the people, you look at the arms, and you look at the proposed course of conduct. As I read this court's case law and the weight of authority among other courts of appeals, this is part of that analysis of whether the proposed course of conduct is covered. That's how we view these ancillary rights questions, and often acquisition is going to be something that does or does not, depending on the proposed course of conduct in the statute that we're analyzing. May or may not be something that impinges on that Second Amendment right. So I would put meaningful constraint there.
For something to be a meaningful constraint, I know there's some language about it for an ancillary right if it effectively denies. Is that, what is your view of, are those the same thing? Something meaningfully constrains if it effectively denies your ability to exercise the right?
Your Honor, I'd say that these are all different ways of saying the same thing. Bruin in footnote 9 explained that sometimes there's going to be a law that by its text does not impinge the Second Amendment.
That's what I thought. And it effectively denies. We've kind of had this issue, I'm sure, in lots of areas, but especially in the Second Amendment, of sort of meaning drift in words. Like, we'll start with something, and before you know it, it effectively denies is, if that's the standard, if you have to show that Second Amendment doesn't cover it unless it effectively denies a right, basically, well, then meaningfully constrains and effectively denies don't sound like the same thing. Effectively denies is really harsh. It's basically you have to show that this means that you don't have any Second Amendment rights at all. How come those two things, how do we get that drift, and how come those two things mean the same thing?
I think you don't need to take that drift. Other circuits' formulations have used words like effectively denies or de facto prohibition. You have been pretty consistent in using the words meaningfully constrains, and I think you've offered content on that in your case law. I think we've learned from, for example—
Well, if it isn't effectively denies, because that does seem like a pretty black and white standard, but seems like a really harsh standard, then meaningfully constrains is kind of fuzzy. So how do we apply that if— how do we apply that standard?
So I think in a facial challenge, the thing you would be looking at when you're looking at a word like meaningfully constrains is whether the plaintiff was able to exercise their right to keep and bear arms. And I think you've explained, for example, in Wynn, that it's not enough to say, well, you've got other guns at home. You've got to be able to get a new gun if that new gun is what it is that you want. And I think you've explained
well, think
another
it, case. Wasn't it Wynn that we said 30 days did meaningfully, like making somebody wait 30 days to get a fire or to get a second firearm, I guess, did meaningfully constrain. But it seems to me somebody could reach a different conclusion and say, well, that's, you know, that's 12 a year. And, you know, my wife thinks that's a lot if I buy 12 a year. So, like, I don't know that meaningfully. I'm having trouble with this. Seems like an inherently fuzzy concept. And you're saying, well, you just look at what meaningfully means, you know, but you don't think it's a fuzzy concept?
No, Your Honor. I think that the fact that all of the courts of appeals have been pretty consistent in how they've resolved these tests and resolved these different new cases have shown that it's a reasonable test that's easy to apply for courts. It's, you know, something that's familiar to you. Having the word meaningfully before a standard is something that courts often apply.
I guess I would argue against the point that you just made about, you know, all the circuits are being consistent. I mean, you read these cases, and it seems to me that the rationale that judges are applying here is all over the map. Like, candidly, I think that the Supreme Court has given us contradictory direction in its case law, and everybody is trying to figure out, what do we do about that? How do we resolve the conflict that is in the language? So I'm not sure that it's true that there is a sort of broad consensus about how this should go.
I think that it is true with respect to acquisition, Your Honor. I think everyone has agreed that when it comes to acquisition, we're talking about an ancillary right. And when we're talking about ancillary rights, you have to add some sort of content. There's something that the plaintiffs have to come forward and show extra in order to be able to
but
show that
the
they're
panel saying, opinion, I mean, I, you know, Judge Bea and Judge Collins, I think, would agree about a whole lot of things. You know, they're not, this is not like people that are complete different ends of the spectrum on a lot of issues. And yet they had diametrically opposed views of whether this meaningfully constrained. And so even the panel opinion in this case seemed like it sort of illustrates how you kind of, it seems like it's more of a, I don't know if I'm going to word it, but a Rorschach block test. Like, you see what you want to see. You don't really necessarily, it doesn't provide guidance as much as, now I'm not saying you can't say whether something meaningfully constrains or not. Judges can say that, but is it actually doing anything? Is it giving judges any guidance?
Your Honor, I think that even if you find the term meaningfully constrained to be a difficult one as a general matter, it's pretty easy to apply in this case because of the evidence that was before the court, the district court at summary judgment, and because of the allegations in the complaint. I think it's very clear that the plaintiffs in this case could get their guns, the guns that they wanted, under the current Hawaii laws, under the 30-day validity period, and under the inspection requirement as reformulated. And I think that that's all you have to decide in this case, whether you decide that's true, there's no meaningful constraint because we're talking about acquisition,
that's
or
if
whether
it means effectively denies, right? Like, because if they could, because it sounds like what you're saying is an effectively denied standard that didn't effectively deny them, and so.
So I think we could win under that standard. I think we could also win even if you say acquisition is fully, you know, is fully covered to the same extent as keep and bear. I think we could still win because we have a shall issue regime, and footnote 9 has explained that shall issue regimes are treated a little bit differently, that they've already been considered to meet a certain standard, and that in order to challenge a provision of a shall issue regime, you need to show that the law had been put to abusive ends, and there's been no showing here on the abusive ends front. So I think we could win through either of those paths, and so if you find that to be a difficult question, you can just look at this case as a shall issue case and answer the abusive ends question.
To what extent do you think these really are viewed as part of a shall issue regime? So take the inspection one first. So it does seem it's sort of removed from the background check process and other things like that that seem like the more the focus of footnote 9.
I disagree, Your Honor, and it's because the inspection requirement is part of registration. So every gun, however it is that you acquire it, needs to be registered. And the way that registration works when it's a gun that you have not acquired from a licensed dealer is that you just have to you've got to bring the gun in for inspection as one component of registration. But everybody, including somebody who buys a gun from a licensed dealer, needs to return that slip that says, I register, I did in fact acquire this gun, and here's the serial number for it. And I did pass the background check, and I did pass the mental health status check. And so it's all part of one unitary scheme.
So you disagree with the panel decision in that respect as well?
I do, Your Honor, and I think that if you're looking for guidance on how to understand whether something is part of a shall issue regime or not, all you have to do is look at footnote 9, which explained that when we're talking about shall issue regime, we're just looking for something that has narrow objective and definite criteria and does not admit discretion on the part of the issuer. So we have very clear statutory requirements as to when it is you do and do not when it is you do not have to comply with the inspection requirement. We have very clear statutory criteria with respect to who would and would not pass the background check and what sorts of mental health statuses are disqualifying. And so this is a very black and white, you can look at the statute and know whether you qualify or not sort of regime.
What case, I guess, do you point to that best supports your proposition that both provisions are not meaningful constraints on the plaintiff's right to keep and bear arms?
We'd rely on BNL, Your Honor. I think that that's the case in which you've most recently and most clearly explained what it is when you're talking about what it is you mean when you're talking about ancillary rights and how to analyze those questions. And we think that this is that same sort of acquisition framework, the same sort of analysis would apply.
And what about any of our sister courts? Which case would you point to?
Sure, Your Honor. We think that McCrory, Judge Smith's opinion for the Fifth Circuit, and McCrory applies the same sort of analysis, explaining that acquisition should be treated differently and that often acquisition won't be a plain text analysis that meets the Second Amendment. I think Judge Larson's opinion for the Sixth Circuit in United States v. Nip is also very instructive on that point. She makes the same point that, of course, it's going to be the case that the Second Amendment protects the right to acquire a firearm only when necessary to enable the acquirer to possess or carry one. So I think that that is the consensus among many different courts of appeals, and it's one that you've adopted already in BNL.
Are you aware of a circuit court decision that takes a different view that any type of acquisition right necessarily falls within the scope of the Second Amendment and therefore necessarily needs to be subject to a history and tradition analysis?
The closest I could offer you on that front would be Judge Rushing's concurrence in Maryland Shall Issue in the Fourth Circuit, in which she said that she read Bruin footnote 9 to mean that when we're talking about shall issue regimes, the Supreme Court has already told you that there is a historical analog at Bruin Step 2 for all shall issue regimes, and that's surety laws. And so she would reach the same result, but through a different method. She would say the historical analysis has already happened, but it's effectively the same outcome as in the other circuits where they've read it more as a step one question.
But I mean, it seems to me it would be hard to square the Supreme Court's presumptively lawful language with getting past the first step of the analysis because they seem to start from opposite ends of the spectrum. I mean, if something's presumptively lawful, then it would seem to not also be a constitutionally protected activity that the government must then justify under a regulatory tradition. Is there a way to square to Judge Forrest's point, these kind of competing points in tension in what the Supreme Court describes as presumptively lawful and the Bruin two-step analysis?
I think the best I could offer you, Your Honor, is an analogy to how it is that we consider other constitutional rights. I mean, it's often going to be the case that in the first instance, a plaintiff must show that their constitutionally protected right has been impinged upon, and then only after that does the state have to come forward and say that that's justified despite the constitutional prohibition. That's the same sort of analysis we're doing here when we say that we're trying to figure out if the proposed course of conduct is one that is protected by the Second Amendment, whether this acquisition law really does affect your keep and bear right, and then at that point, after the plaintiff has made that show, knowing that their right has been impinged upon, would the state come forward with our evidence that that's actually okay? And in this case, that would be this historical evidence that we would need to move forward with.
So I want to jump in on that point because I'm very interested in how we treat rights generally as opposed to just how we treat the Second Amendment rights, so that there's consistency across our constitutional law doctrine. And I'm aware that one of our principles that we share across other rights is that if a regulation incidentally burdens a constitutional right, it's not a violation. We've said that in the context of the Sixth Amendment. We've said that in the context of the First Amendment. I think we've said that in the context of the Fifth Amendment. So what would that mean here if we looked at, if we said that acquisition, yes, is covered by the Second Amendment because you have to be able to acquire to possess. We've said that. Other courts have said that. That seems like a common sense proposition to me. So if we say that the Second Amendment applies, but then we look at this rule and we say, is it an incidental burden or not? Where would that fit in the Bruin analysis, or does it fit in the Bruin analysis?
I think, Your Honor, that you could offer that as an alternative way of understanding the meaningful constraint test. I mean, it seems to me that if you're talking about something that's an incidental burden on the right, it's not something that meaningfully constrains. So if I were to try and put that into Bruin's framework, I would also put that in the proposed course of conduct analysis and say we're talking about that same first step, Bruin textual analysis. Is this something that affects the Second Amendment right? And here we're saying it's incidental. I think that that's a reasonable way of understanding things. Of course, there are many ancillary rights that are going to affect your right to keep and bear. I mean, obviously, if you don't have enough money to buy a gun, that's going to be something that affects your right to keep and bear. But there's no constitutional right to have enough money to buy a gun. So that could be something that's an incidental burden that's not the state's fault. You could analyze it from that perspective. I would just say that it's the opposite of the meaningful constraint.
So would you say that the regulations involved in this case are incidental burdens or more than that?
I would agree that they're incidental burdens. Right. I would say that they don't burden, but if you must find that there is a burden, I would say that burden is incidental.
So let's take the inspection. We've talked a little bit about the in-person inspection. Why is it an incidental burden to require somebody who has already obtained possession of property to have to present it to the state at the state's decree? Why is that incidental? It may be permissible, but why is it merely incidental?
As opposed to a meaningfully constraint?
I mean, set aside, I'm not sure the incidental burden and that analysis marries on to meaningful constraint. I think those might be two separate things. But an incidental burden is one that, I mean, I guess other terminology in the law might be a de minimis imposition on a right, right? And we just say, like, this is too small, too trivial, to whatever word you want to give it to, that for the law to take attention to this. So why is having to show up with something that you have already obtained possession of, it is your personal property, and you have to bring it to bear to the government for it to inspect? Like, you know, normally in other inspection contexts, you know, the Fourth Amendment gets triggered. We don't treat those things as incidental or trivial. So why would that be trivial?
I think I hesitate to call it trivial, Your Honor, but if that's the format of the hypo, I would say that it's not a burden because it's not actually preventing you from keeping and bearing. Like, the constitutional right is not to have complete privacy in your gun ownership. The constitutional right is to be able to keep and bear arms, whether that's to walk around town with them or whether that's to keep them in your home. That was the substance of Bruin and Heller. And I don't think that the court ever said that there was going to be no way in which the state could impinge upon that right. And in fact, the court went out of its way to say there are, in fact, ways in which the state can impinge upon that right. That was the point of Bruin footnote 9. That was the point of the Kavanaugh concurrence, which commanded the chief's vote as well. And of course, without Kavanaugh and the chief, you would not have had a majority in Bruin. And so I think the Supreme Court has actually gone out of its way to explain that, yes, of course, the state can burden your right a little bit. And there are certain circumstances in which that's going to be okay. There's a reason why the court specifically carved out background checks and mental health status and any other narrow, objective, and definite criteria. There is a strong holding from the Supreme Court that those things must be permissible.
Well, I mean, one could listen to the exchanges here and kind of ask, you know, is this getting a little too far away from Bruin in the sense that it seems like by the logic of some of these arguments, whether it's meaningful constraint or incidental or some other test, we're not leaving a whole lot of room for the analogical reasoning to come into play, the history and tradition component that Bruin seemed to emphasize heavily. How would you respond to that potential criticism?
The first thing I would say, Your Honor, is that I think that you'd only get to the historical analysis after you've done the plain text analysis, and I think that we're still in plain text world. And of course, if the plaintiff can make the showing that they need to make at the plain text stage, the state will have to come forward with historical analogs. To the extent that you disagree with that view, though, I would commend Judge Rushing's reasoning to you, and my argument would be that this is a shall issue regime, and the Supreme Court has already held under Judge Rushing's reasoning, which I think is a very fair reading of footnote 9, that all shall issue regimes have satisfied the Supreme Court's analysis of step two as analogs of surety laws.
And how about the reference to abusive laws? Is that some separate test or is that part of the same inquiry?
It's a slightly different part of the inquiry. And so I think that what the abusive ends analysis is acknowledging is there may be a law that is facially constitutional in the sense that it does permit on narrow objective indefinite criteria somebody to keep and bear arms. But the problem is that in practice, it operates as such a constraint on the an individual's right to keep and bear arms that it's something that is actually preventing somebody from keeping and bearing arms. And so it's meant to be a practical analysis. Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence explains that the as-applied challenge must, of course, always be there. It could be, for example, that you have a wait time that's you only get one gun a month and you've got to wait 30 days after every gun you apply for, and that's going to be an excessive amount of time. Or you could have a restraint where the background check fee, instead of being $42, is actually $1,000, and that's going to be prohibitively expensive for most people to use. And so it could be that there are objective indefinite criteria that prevent you from keeping and bearing arms, and that's what that abusive ends point is the state can't do that.
I'm a little confused at your answer, because the first part of your answer seemed like you were saying, basically, facially, you could have what I think a lot of people would think would be very onerous requirements, but if they're being applied a certain way, that would be abusive. So I thought that was your answer to the abusive at the beginning, but then you started the examples you were giving were examples of things that would be facially, like a really high, a really high fee, or 30 days, since we already have precedent on that. And so, which is it? Like, because if you can have facial requirements like a high fee, then I kind of go back to where do we draw the line? That puts us like what counts as enough to meaningfully constrain or to not be de minimis or to whatever language we want to use. And I'm struggling with what kind of guidance, because practically speaking, I doubt seriously that very many of us are purchasing firearms or ammunition or any number of things. So we don't have like real life experience to judge this by. We're basically just asking ourselves an abstract question of does this seem to meaningfully constrain? And so somewhat not surprisingly, given that we don't do this very much, it doesn't, our answer is very different than it might be if we were purchasing internet service or any number of other things that we purchase regularly. So that's what I'm struggling with, because it seemed like your answer initially was, I thought I was taking away from it that it really can almost put any barrier. I'm calling it a barrier. Let's use a different word. Any requirements that you want, as long as they don't completely eliminate your ability to, in this instance, get a firearm. But if you apply those somehow abusively, is that your answer? Or is your answer that things that make it difficult to get can rise to the level, even if they're across-the-board requirements, like too high a rate? Too high an amount.
The as-applied answer that I was giving about abusive was about as-applied challenges. So when you have a shall issue regime, the Supreme Court has exempted shall issue regimes like at a categorical level.
What if you had a shall issue regime that had a $3,000 per permit requirement for everybody? You couldn't bring a facial to that, and you'd have to bring an as-applied and say, I'm not a billionaire, so $3,000 is a lot of money for me, I guess, but a billion. I'm trying to figure out, why wouldn't you be able to bring a facial for that unless your position is those things are just like that doesn't prevent a person from getting one. If you can scrape together $3,000. I'm trying to figure out what your position is.
I think the Supreme Court has been very selective about facial challenges in recent years. And I think that, even 10 years ago, my answer to that question would have been, yes, of course you can bring a facial challenge to that type of regulation. My answer, 4 years ago or 2 years ago would have been that case. But I think that in a post, CASA world, in a post-Moody world, I think the Supreme Court has been very rigorous about how narrow facial challenges are.
I understand why you're – I understand why you're attracted to the barrier to bringing facial challenges, and I understand the arguments there. So, are you saying, let's use a hypothetical, $10,000 per year permit requirement? You could not bring a facial challenge to that as a meaningful constraint.
That you could not bring a facial challenge.
Yeah. Could you bring a
Somebody could bring a facial challenge, and I could very much imagine the set of the evidence that would be offered. It could be winnable. It could be the case that that almost all Hawaiians would not be able to acquire as many guns as they would want to be able to acquire with a $10,000 fee. I mean, if you have a $10,000 fee, even a billionaire might find it difficult to get as many guns as they want.
So I thought, I think like you have to say that. So as soon as we say that, then meaningfully constrains is some sort of standard that you can have. That can be violated by things like having to bring your gun in person or something. I mean, then we have to ask ourselves whether it meaningfully constrains. I'm just trying to figure out how your standard holds up, because it's not a complete You can do in some ways, you keep saying that your standard is you can do anything you want as long as it doesn't completely keep somebody from being able to exercise their First Amendment rights, Second Amendment rights by getting a firearm. But then later you'll concede that, no, there are things that would be a barrier. If I make a hypothetical that's like hard enough. So then how are we supposed to evaluate whether something meaningfully constrains, if it is possible for requirement to be too onerous?
Your Honor, facial challenges are hard. And when you offer hypotheticals that are very difficult and that would make it extremely difficult for most people to acquire a firearm, I'm going to tell you that that's something that could be the basis of a facial challenge. But Rahimi does say that you need to be able to not imagine any application of that law that would be constitutional in order for it to be a facial challenge.
The problem with that is you can always do that. That's the problem. You can always say for Elon Musk, $10,000 isn't a problem. That's the problem with that. I don't know what the Supreme Court is thinking. I don't think they know what they're thinking. But that's the problem with that, with this facial thing we keep relying on, the facial.
Let me ask you a question, if I can. Where do you believe this shall issue presumption resides in the Bruin two-step analysis? Does it apply to the specific provisions challenged in this case?
Do I believe that this is a shall issue regime? Yes, Your Honor, I do believe this is a shall issue regime.
And where do you apply it then?
I would apply that at Bruin step one. I think that footnote 9 has explained that we're at step one when we're talking about shall issue regimes. But again, like I was saying to your colleague, that if you disagreed with that, you could go with the judge fishing view and say that they're analyzed at step two, but are all analogs of surety laws.
Can I ask you, whether it's facial or as applied, how would you analyze a law like the inspection law that instead of 30 days said 24 hours? How would you analyze that? You have to purchase, the purchase provision. You have to purchase it within 24 hours.
Yeah, I would look at what evidence was offered at summary judgment, and I would look at the allegations in the complaint, and perhaps a plaintiff in that situation would say, I got off the plane from the mainland, and I had just moved here, and I brought my guns with me, and it was just infeasible for X, Y, and Z reason. I showed up on a Friday, and the police...
That's an as-applied.
Exactly,
right?
And you could say that...
So could you have a facial challenge in that scenario?
I think you could if you showed that as a general matter it was the vast majority of people or nearly everyone would be unable to comply with that requirement such that it would make it very hard or nearly impossible or effectively deny or meaningfully constrain most people from being able to keep and bear arms.
So would you say that the 24-hour period would be a meaningful constraint?
I would say that we offer 5 days.
You offer 5 days for the inspection, but how about for the purchase?
Oh, if there were only 24 hours in which you could purchase a gun. Hawaii has modified its laws to be more permissive, and now there are 30 days in which to acquire a gun. I'm not able to offer an answer. The state does not have a position on whether 1 day would be enough. We definitely thought that 10 days was enough, but it's certainly the case that 30 is.
Right. I'm just trying to figure out how you draw the distinction. So if 30 days is enough and 10 days is enough and 1 day may not be enough, what is doing the work? What tests are being applied to help us make those judgments?
Yeah, so the test that's being applied to help make that judgment is that meaningful constraint rule. The plaintiffs have said, this law is unlawful, and the next question you ask is, did it stop you from keeping and bearing? And the answer to that question is no. I mean, if you look at the evidence that was offered at the summary judgment stage, there's no statement that they were unable to keep and bear arms as a result of this, as a result of a 30-day period. There's a statement that they tried to buy a gun.
Can I ask about that, though, procedure? Because you amended it after. So they did bring in evidence that they couldn't comply with the 7-day time period.
They offered some statements about why the 10-day period was difficult for them to meet. I would say that most of that was not.
You didn't think that was enough either. But when you amend it, then – I'm trying to figure out how we can expect them to have an as-applied challenge to a kind of a constantly changing law. I mean, you changed it like 3 times.
After we changed it, Your Honor, we did suggest that this court should remand to the district court so that we could do this.
Well,
type
that
of
runs
analysis
into a whole separate issue, which we won't get into. But how is that fair? I guess my question is, how is that fair to put that burden on the plaintiff when they come in and bring a challenge? I used to think you were correct. I'm now second-guessing in light of Hawaii's repeated approach here where they just keep amending it. So every time a plaintiff comes in, then they just amend it. And then you say, well, you don't have any evidence. Well, that's because they didn't challenge that specific law. They challenged the other law, and then you amended it.
Your Honor, the Attorney General does did not change the law here. The legislature changed the law, and you know, these are different branches of government. We don't control one another. We are separate from one another. And so I cannot say what it was that prompted the legislature to make a change or whether there will ever be a change again. What I can say is that with respect to this particular law that's in front of us, whether you analyze it at the 10-day mark or whether you analyze it at the 30-day mark, there just isn't evidence in the record showing that the plaintiffs were unable to keep and bear. And I think that if the answer is that the state of Hawaii has loosened its restrictions, then I think the plaintiffs are able to get what they want. I mean, if you were to look at this through a mootness lens, you'd be asking, were the plaintiffs able to achieve their goals? Were they able to get what they wanted? And right now, they want guns that aren't subject to the inspection requirement. They want extra time to purchase guns, and they have both of those things. And so we would say they've gotten what they wanted out of this lawsuit.
In Nguyen, we concluded that the purpose of the statute, the one gun a month law, was delay. That the reason California had passed that was for the purpose of delay, and that was abusive. That was not a legitimate means. So here, given Hawaii's repeated amendments of its statutes, can we conclude that the purpose of these statutes is to create impediments and to prevent people or to make it difficult for people to acquire firearms, and that is abusive?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. And I think that the most important thing that I hope that you take from those amendments is that they were all amendments to make it easier to buy guns.
After Hawaii lost before the district court, right? So, and then this happened also in another case we had, Teeter, involving the knives, the butterfly knives. So, I mean, we've seen Hawaii doing this repeatedly where it feels like they're sort of jerking around their citizens by throwing up something that's meant to make it difficult to acquire a weapon or to keep and bear a weapon. And then when they get pushback from the courts and they amend the statute. And to me, that seems to be evidence that this is abusive. These aren't regulations that have a longstanding in our historical tradition, that there's some other motivation. I know you said you're not here on behalf of the legislature, but you're here on behalf of Hawaii, and Hawaii is the state that is doing this. So I don't think you can dodge the answer by saying I'm here on behalf of the Attorney General.
Sure, Your Honor. And the answer that I would give you that is most direct to that is that to the extent the legislature has been responsive to what is happening in the judiciary, that responsiveness has been to make it easier to get guns. What Hawaii keeps doing is saying, a district court judge has said that this type of provision violated the Second Amendment. Here's what we'll do. We'll get rid of that restricted provision. We'll make it less restrictive. We'll go from 10 days, which the district court said was too short, to 30 days. We're going to triple the time. We'll say that the district court said too many guns were being inspected. We'll really narrow that requirement. So the vast majority of guns that are purchased in Hawaii aren't going to be subject to that requirement.
The amendments had sunset clauses, right? So they would revert back to the previous statute, which is additional evidence that Hawaii is just moving the goalpost at will when they feel like they can do that to get around judicial decisions. So how are we to know that Hawaii won't change these periods again so that the acquisition permit is good for 24 hours or 2 days and the inspection has to happen within 3 hours, 24 hours or 2 days?
So two things, Your Honor. One, I think that if you keep moving the goalposts so that it's easier for the plaintiffs to score a touchdown, that's a good thing. I think the legislature is being responsive in the right way.
How do we know that they're going to do that? I mean, having a sunset clause in those amendments does not suggest that that is what Hawaii intends to do.
The sunset provisions were removed, Your Honor. So these rules are permanent now. There's been a permanent loosening of all of the restrictions. And the other thing I would say, Your Honor, is that there's a presumption of regularity with respect to governments in throughout any type of litigation. We do think that governments mean well and are trying to do the right thing. And I think that when somebody makes a change to make it easier for the plaintiffs in a way that's responsive to a court decision, that's something that should be commended on the part of the legislature, that they are trying to be responsive in a way that helps the plaintiffs.
I want to ask you something about your argument with respect to facial challenges. So if there is a regulation that implicates the plain text of it implicates the plain text of the Second Amendment and it is not supported by our nation's historical tradition of regulation of firearms, so it fails under both prongs of the Bruin test, does a plaintiff then have to show that in every application it's unconstitutional? I mean, how do you import this facial as applied analysis if the regulation fails under Bruin?
If it fails at step two, it fails at step two, Your Honor. We're not saying that there's some sort of additional analysis that you would do after step two. If a plaintiff has brought a facial challenge, like let's say we're talking about the McRory situation from the Fifth Circuit where there's an age restriction. Nobody who is under the age of 16 is able to buy a firearm, and that's something that applies to all people under the age of 16. That's a reasonable facial challenge. It's unconstitutional in all of its applications. You get to step two, and you know we would say at step two there's going to be historical analogs for that. But if there were not, then that would be the end of that law.
Thank you. So if there's a regulation and it implicates the text of the Second Amendment, so and then there's no historical analog, you would not then turn around and say, but it could be constitutional in some instances. You would not make that argument. Is that what I understand you to say?
With respect to the remedy?
With respect to the analysis, because part of what I think is problematic with our case law is that we're sort of smuggling back in the tiers of analysis. In Tijera, sitting on banc, we said that acquisition is protected under the Second Amendment, but we didn't decide to what extent. That was pre-Bruin. Then B&L Products, just last year, came up with this meaningful constraint analysis that I think was made up out of whole cloth in that opinion. It wasn't in our case law. It's not in Bruin. It's not in Heller. And then now we seem to have these subjective levels of scrutiny again. Then we have the issue of, well, if you can imagine some application where it's constitutional, then it doesn't violate Bruin. I mean, that's what I understood you to say in response to Judge Van Dyke's question earlier.
No, Your Honor, that's not my position. There will be certain laws, including laws on acquisition, that could be unconstitutional in all of their applications, and that's going to be something like a blanket ban. Or take, for example, the law that this court recently analyzed that was about how you could not get a permit to carry a gun if you were in a county with a population of greater than 200,000. That's going to be something that's unconstitutional in all of its application, and that is something that's a reasonable basis for a facial challenge. What we're talking about is when you dig down into the plaintiff's complaint and the issue that they're highlighting that prevents them from keeping and bearing firearms is respect to their personal circumstances. If it's something that it's not all applications of the law, that it, actually most people can purchase a gun within 30 days of the time they say they want to purchase it. That 30-day permits is plenty of time to get a gun that you've bought. But it could be that for a particular plaintiff, they're unable to do it within that time. It's for the particular plaintiff, it's an as-applied challenge, it would only operate, the remedy would only operate again for that particular plaintiff.
Okay, sorry, I don't want to interrupt you. I apologize for interrupting you, but I want to get a question. And is it your position that the acquisition of a firearm is not implicated by the plain text of the Second Amendment? In other words, it's not keep and bear, so it's entitled to some lesser degree of protection? It's an ancillary right? Is that that acquisition is somehow not protected by the Second Amendment or not protected to the same degree as keep and bear?
Our position is that it's not always going to be protected by the Second Amendment, that often it will be, but sometimes it won't be. But even if
but
you
just... How do you draw the distinction? I mean, is there...
The meaningful constraint test is how you draw the distinction. It could be that with respect to ancillary rights, you end up
and
hitting
that
the
comes
full...
only from B&L products, right?
The meaningful constraint rule.
Right. I mean, the Supreme Court has never said that. They've never suggested that test. In fact, they said the opposite. They pretty strongly rejected all these tiers of scrutiny in Bruin.
So... The meaningful constraint test is not a means end sort of scrutiny. We're not talking about the legislature's rationale.
I mean, it just brings back in this subjective analysis of instead of having a bright line, this is protected by the text of the Second Amendment. Now you have to show a historical analog to justify that restriction. You would say, well, before we get there, we're going to shuffle these degrees, rights into various degrees, and maybe acquiring a firearm really does bear on whether you can keep and bear a firearm because you can't keep and bear a firearm if you can't acquire it. I mean,
In most cases, yes, Your Honor. But there will be certain situations like the situation that Judge Larson was considering in the Sixth Circuit when she said that acquisition is going to be different with respect to a law that prohibited receiving a firearm from a felon. She said in that particular instance, that prohibition did not meaningfully constrain the right to keep and bear firearms because you can acquire firearms from people who are not felons. Or like what Judge Smith was saying in the Fifth Circuit where he said background checks for 17-year-olds is not going to be something that prevents you from keeping and bearing arms, even though it's a regulation on acquisition. That not every acquisition case is going to be an acquisition case that affects your right to keep and bear arms in a negative way.
Thank you. Thank you. Counsel.
Good morning. If it may please the court, my name is Alan Beck, and I'm counsel for the plaintiff appellee, Todd Yukitaki and David Kikawa. With me in the court is Mr. Yukitaki. I'm going to endeavor to make 3 points during my presentation. It's an initial matter, B&L needs to be overturned. It doesn't square with the Supreme Court's precedent, and simply has no basis in American jurisprudence. If this court does not, the second is, if this court does not overturn B&L, the only way to square, say that something is a meaningful constraint without, you know, contradicting the Supreme Court is to find that anything that implicates arms-bearing conduct is a meaningful constraint. Finally, if this court were to adopt my friend on the other side's position, then this court would split with both the Tenth Circuit in Ortega and the Fifth Circuit in McGraw. Ortega, the Tenth Circuit found that waiting period of 7 days was unconstitutional. That clearly is not a complete ban on acquiring an arm.
What was that waiting period, though? There's a number of waiting periods before you can buy a new gun. This is different, and I'm trying to figure out where this one fits in from Hawaii, because you've already had the waiting period, you've already had the background check, and then there's a requirement that you take your permit in within, I guess, either 10 days initially or 30 days. Where does that fit in? I understand your point that that's inconsistent with Ortega, but the facts seem different. I mean, it seems to be more an analogy that if that was unconstitutional in Ortega, then this even has to be more unconstitutional.
Yes, I agree with that statement, Your Honor. Yeah. There's just simply, this doesn't really accomplish anything. What's the point of doing this in 30 days? And also the 5-day inspection period. I mean, these are arms that already have been owned by the individual. It's but additionally, I just want to address.
What if the firearm does not have a serial number? What if it's a ghost gun or a 3D printed gun? Why wouldn't there be a reasonable basis for Hawaii to want to inspect to make sure that there's a print of a registration number on the gun itself, or that it aligns with the rest of the registration requirements?
This law applies to firearms that are bought through a mainland FFL. So there's already ATF inspections that occur at any type of FFL all throughout this country. Second, this law applies to firearms that are purchased through the Civilian Marksmanship Program, which come directly from the federal government.
But what is – so I'm trying to understand how to square Bruin's discussion of presumptively lawful regimes that relate to the acquisition of firearms, background checks, mental health checks, safety firearm training programs, which are not incidental things. I mean, people have to go through many steps in order to do them, in order to acquire a firearm. But repeatedly now, the court has said that these are presumptively lawful regimes, and they didn't subject those regimes to some analysis of history and tradition. So do you agree that there are presumptively lawful regimes under Bruin?
Under Bruin, the court has identified certain types of characteristics which are found in shall issue regimes that square with our historical tradition of arms bearing regulation.
But the court didn't anchor that in an analysis in Bruin of history and tradition. I don't remember the court discussing a history and tradition to background checks.
That's said because this was in a footnote,
right,
Your Honor. This was dicta. It was Supreme Court dicta. But I mean, the court, that wasn't the matter before the court. So the court didn't engage in a full-blown analysis.
Counsel, I find that response a little bit unsatisfactory, because if there was only one reference to this idea in one Supreme Court opinion in one footnote, then maybe that would make sense. But there's a reference to this idea in every single modern Supreme Court Second Amendment case. that there's going to be this body of regulatory area that we're not casting doubt on. They say that every time. We've had four different authors in these cases, and all four of them have said it. So what do we make of that?
I think what we make of that is that the colonial period in this nation wasn't simply just a firearms free-for-all. I mean, there was quite a few laws were on the books that did regulate arms-bearing conduct. And the court has looked back on that in every single one of these cases and seen there are some regulations that did occur during the colonial era, Your Honor.
So I guess following up on Judge Sanchez's question, I have a related question, and that is, would you agree with me that if we're at Bruin Step 2, then whatever regulation we're looking at is presumptively unlawful until the state overcomes that burden by showing history and tradition support it? You agree with me with that?
I agree that there's an affirmative duty on the part of the government to justify its regulations under Step 2 of the Bruin analysis, Your Honor.
Okay, so I think, as Judge Sanchez, I think, is saying, is if we're going to say that things are presumptively lawful, that's in tension with what's going on at Step 2 of Bruin. So my question is, what do we, like, where does it fall in the analysis?
The court was very clear in Rahimi that if something regulates arms-bearing conduct, then it implicates plain text when we go to Step 2. And that's in the full body of the opinion, Your Honor.
It's going to be very difficult to say that the right to acquire is not covered by the text of the Second Amendment, because the right to possess means nothing if you can't actually acquire. So the text is going, I mean, it seems to me, and it seems like there is some, we were talking about there's not a lot of consensus. There seems to be pretty good consensus on that small point in any event. So if that's true, then what? Every regulation, I think your argument is every regulation that touches on the ability to acquire, because we're going to say it's covered under the Second Amendment, is presumptively bad until the state overcomes their burden. And that is contrary to these carve-outs in every single Supreme Court case.
Yes, Your Honor, but at the, I think what's happened here is, the Supreme Court has looked to the history for us in certain circumstances and said that, in the case of certain background checks, things like that.
Are you relying on the rushing reasoning that your friend across the aisle referenced?
I am not, Your Honor. I'm just saying that's the only way that we could square the footnotes with the main body of the text, because, Rahimi and Bruin have been very clear that it's a very simple test. If it's something that regulates arms-bearing conduct, then we go to Step 2. So if we accept that and we accept these footnotes are valid, then it has to be that the court is just simply suggesting that we've looked at the history.
Can I clarify your argument? Yeah, are you saying that under your interpretation of footnote 9, the Supreme Court has already gone to the Bruin Step 2, done the analysis for us, but yet never explicitly said so because it was in the context of a footnote?
I'm saying that in dicta, Your Honor, the court is suggesting that these types of regulations square with history. Therefore, we're going to not under Step 2
survive. Right. Well, the court said in footnote 9 that 43 states have shall issue licensing regimes, and then it talked about the different types of permitting regimes that are presumptively lawful. You're saying that the district court already looked at history and tradition in determining that those shall issue regimes are constitutional.
I'm saying...
Did I get your argument correct?
That's essentially correct. I'm saying that footnote 9, when it looks at a shall issue system, we have to accept that obviously a shall issue system is a, it deals with bearing an arm, so it implicates the first step.
Counsel, I guess I don't understand your answer, because if that's like when the Supreme Court does its historical analysis, it's pages and pages long. I don't see where they've done the work to say that their conclusion or the carve-out that seems to be occurring in all these cases is supported by historical analysis. Where would you point us to see that work has been done?
Your Honor, I mean, in each one of those examples where the Supreme Court's made these suggestions, I mean, they're essentially foreshadowing for the future, because those are not the matter
before. It's really not there. So if we disagree with you and find that this falls within the shall issue licensing regimes that the court was talking about in footnote 9 and approved as being presumptively constitutional, then where's the meaningful constraints in these particular provisions as compared to the examples that the court gave in footnote 9?
Well, these are dramatically different laws than the shall issue laws of 43 states.
How many states have laws like the two we have here?
Registration law is within 5 days, doesn't exist anywhere in the country. Now, the only place that had it was D.C., and that was struck down in Heller 3, Your Honor.
So you said that this is dramatically different. How is it more meaningfully burdensome than the examples given by the Supreme Court? Is it more meaningfully burdensome than having to complete a firearm safety course?
Yes, absolutely. Part of this system is you have to complete a firearm safety course. But for example, if you don't use your permit within 30 days, you have to wait another 40 days in order to get another permit, and then use that one within 30 days. And that's nothing
But counsel, I share Judge Wynn's question. I'm having a hard time understanding why this is any more onerous than something like a course. Presumably that also takes some time. It requires someone to go someplace. So I'd like to hear the answer to that question.
Well, a course takes a few hours, Your Honor. A safety course, is something that in Hawaii, I mean, if you don't use this this permit within 30 days, I mean, you're going to have to wait about another 40 days in order to.
30 days. If this week is not convenient, then go get it next week. That seems less burdensome than having to set aside time from possibly from work and sign up for a safety course somewhere.
Also, I'd just like to note that...
Can I just ask a clarification? I thought you had to go back through the safety course. I thought you had to start over. I thought that was... Maybe I'm all wet on this, but I thought the argument was you went through all these requirements, and then if you don't apply within 30 days, it's as if you didn't do them and you had to start over.
Yes, Ronnie. I mean, you have to go...
So right. I don't understand why this wouldn't be more onerous, because you're actually putting every requirement initially on the table, plus now you're saying if you don't actually, I don't want to say pull the trigger, but if you don't apply within 30 days, then you got to go redo the whole thing again.
Yes, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I'd just like to note in most of the country where there's these types
of... So you're saying that 30 days is not long enough. Would 45 days be acceptable? At what point?
I think
any constraint would be unacceptable because you have to start over again.
I think with all these laws, it has to be justified through history. That's my ultimate position, Your Honor.
So they argue that the surety laws apparently are the historical analog. I didn't hear any other historical analogs mentioned by Hawaii. If we get to prong two, what are the historical analogs? Or your position is... There aren't any.
I don't see any of the laws that issue before the court, Your Honor.
Can you address the surety positions that Hawaii was relying on?
Yes, Your Honor. The surety laws required a judicial determination that someone had the potential to be dangerous for a firearm, and that required them to post a bond. That's dramatically different than laws here. For one thing, they're laws of general applicability. They don't require judicial determination. And there's no finding that my client, Mr. Yukitaki, is somehow unsafe with a firearm. In fact, there's the opposite because, he's just completed a firearm safety course. Whereas the
shirt. And the background check, right?
And the background check, Your Honor. And in addition to that, you sign a. Waiver of your medical privacy rights. So the state of Hawaii has the right to go into every single one of your medical files for your entire life back to the day you were born. I mean, this is a really comprehensive system.
Counsel, what is a historical analog for a background check? The one that the Supreme Court already foretold was makes this presumptively lawful. What's the historical record for a background check as a historical analog?
Your Honor, we haven't challenged that. So the
You're saying surety laws are not a correct analog for Hawaii for these type of laws. I'm just trying to get, but we understand that a background check is presumptively lawful. So what's the historical basis for a background check?
Your Honor, I mean, they haven't built a record on that, so I mean, I haven't been able to rebut that. I mean, under the Bruton analysis, the basis, the burdens upon the government.
I'll jump in because I see where Judge Sanchez is going here. I think the question is that the Supreme Court has said that that's presumptively lawful. You're saying that has to be a step two analysis. So I think what he's asking is that, well, what is the analog that the Supreme Court must have been pointing to? If it's a step two, if we're on step two, that means they've done some sort of analysis. What is the example they're using from history?
Your Honor, what I was saying earlier is I believe based upon footnote 9 that we have a strong suggestion they have, but, you know, the Supreme Court didn't engage in a full-blown historical analysis in footnote 9. So,
That also then suggests maybe this is just a step one analysis, correct? I mean, I think footnote 9 is a real problem for you in this case. So it's either step one and then you lose, or it's step two and then you got to help us understand why the step two in Bruin is not the step two here.
Your Honor, I mean, again, I mean, we have to rectify footnote 9 with the overall body of the opinion. It says if something regulates arms-bearing conduct, then we go to step two. Now, just because the Supreme Court didn't do a full-blown historical analysis with you know, footnote 9 doesn't mean we don't have to square a footnote with the main body of the opinion that's very clear in its command that if something, you know, is deals, you know, bearing, keeping, you know, any of that sort of stuff, an arm, I mean, we go right to history. So we just know just sort of by definition.
You're saying you haven't identified a historical analog.
I have not, Your Honor.
A separate question. Your second point was that you think B&L should be overruled?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, can you tell what specifically, which specific, because I'm reading B&L, it makes a, there's a lot of serial kind of holdings and distinguishing phrases, and I'm just wondering what exactly.
Well, I think that the meaningful constraint test should be overruled, and this court should simply make a.
What would you replace it with?
I would just have this court adopt the Supreme Court's holding, pre-existing holding, that if something implicates arms-bearing conduct, we go to step two. It's as simple as that. This court doesn't have to.
Didn't meaningfully constrained come from Texera?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we need to overrule that too. The Texera case.
Well, Texera was pre Bruin for one thing, Your Honor.
But I mean, we have several cases now that have all relied on the meaningful constraint sort of paradigm. You know, Texera, B&L, Nguyen. They all sort of reflect the notion that if this is an ancillary right, there has to be something to over, you know, to trigger a step two analysis.
I don't think this court has to overturn Texera, and this is why. Texera wasn't dealing with, didn't implicate the direct possessory interest of, yeah, you know, it wasn't an individual person that was suing here. In Texera, we were dealing with a gun store that, and there was a gun store something like 50 feet away from, or maybe. It was within, you know, a couple hundred feet
of the school.
Yeah.
And the statute prohibited having gun stores within X number of feet of the school.
Yes, Your Honor. But there were plenty, the record also demonstrated there were plenty of other gun stores in Alameda County.
Right.
That's and true. That's a dramatically different situation than what we have here, where we have a real human being that's has to deal with a set of laws that. You know, that make it harder for him to exercise.
He said in Texera, you have the right to sell guns, but not anywhere, anytime of your own choosing.
Yes, Your Honor.
There can be, unless, if it's a meaningful constraint, then the law wouldn't stand. But unless your right to sell somewhere, sometime, is meaningfully constrained, then it's constitutional.
Yes, and you know, Texera, you know, we can distinguish Texera from the situation here.
Then
and
why would we have to overrule it?
Well, that's why I'm saying we don't need to overturn. Texera doesn't need to overturn. Maybe
so what
B&L.
What confuses me is that Texera was like maybe the first in our circuit that used meaningful constraint. Now other cases have all used meaningful constraint. All B&L does is follow all that precedent. I don't understand why that has to be overruled, why this whole case has to be overruled.
Well, I certainly don't need to. B&L doesn't need to be overruled for us to win. I just think that B&L needs to be overruled because it's contradictory to what the Supreme Court has said in its last two Supreme Court cases, Your Honor.
But is your how many licensed firearm dealers are there in Hawaii? Are there licensed firearm dealers in Hawaii?
There's FFLs.
Beg your pardon?
Federally licensed firearms dealers? Yes, there are. I don't know how many there
Assume are. A number, correct?
There are a number, yes.
So your client can go to any licensed firearm dealer and get a gun. Is that correct?
If he applies with the various federal laws at issue, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So it seems like the second provision here is specifically targeted regarding this inspection for non-licensed dealers, ghost guns, and those brought from out of state. Is that correct?
Yes, but brought from out of state that was purchased from a FFL, a licensed firearms dealer, in the on the mainland someplace, or through the civilian marksmanship program, where my client we filed a declaration in response to the motion to dismiss that demonstrates he also buys firearms through the civilian marksmanship program as well, and and he occasionally buys firearms from the mainland, so he this is something that still impacts him.
Yeah, but he could choose to buy from a licensed firearms place, which I think is Chief Judge Murguia's point. I mean, there's plenty of them. Why manufacture a gun or whatever they do it? Why do that where you potentially don't have a serial number? And isn't it reasonable for the state to want to make sure all the guns have serial numbers that are registered?
The firearms that my clients are saying they want to buy, I mean, one's, for example, civilian marksmanship programs through the federal government, Your Honor. I mean, that has serial number.
I'm sorry. Okay, I get that point. But you don't think the state of Hawaii has a reasonable interest in seeing that number as part of the registration process?
Well, but you...
Recording that number?
You already
when
have...
When it's imported into Hawaii from another state?
You're already able to. I mean, you still have to register it under the current regime, even if it's a firearm that is brought from a Hawaii FFL. I mean, they could simply go. They should go through the same process as the firearms are brought through the Hawaii FFL, Your Honor.
Can I ask a question about this? Because maybe this would crystallize it a little better. Because I mean this. When I take my car in, maybe this is just Idaho, when I take my car in to register it, I have to take my actual car, and they come out and they check my VIN number against the registration. That's a car. Why isn't the same thing permissible for a gun? I mean, and the reason I'm asking this question is because I think these two restrictions, can be treated differently. But I'm not sure I understand what the complaint is about having to bring the gun in and show the registration requirement if I have to do the same thing with my car.
Well, for one thing, Your Honor, the vast majority of the guns at issue here are purchased through either the federal government or an FFL. Also, even in private party transfers, these guns are already registered by definition. So the government has... the serial numbers.
No, they have my VIN number too. I mean, I that's what I don't understand. I mean, look, I don't like it. I don't like having to bring that actual car in and walking out with somebody.
Well, there's not a constitutional right at issue as well, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's the difference. Is
yes.
that because there's a constitutional right, you
yes,
can't
yes,
do
Your
it
Honor.
Here. Okay.
So in your view, any type of regulation, you don't buy this ancillary right dichotomy. So you know, you can clarify it if I'm mistaken about this. Any type of gun regulation, government regulation for the acquisition, no matter how incidental, let's say it's a $5 licensing fee and that were challenged, in your view, would that need to go through a step two Bruin analysis because purchasing a gun is automatically covered by the Second Amendment?
Yes, Your Honor.
A 50 cent quarter? 25
yes,
cents?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. One penny. As long as it implicates the arms-bearing conduct, we go to step two, right? And, you know, there's plenty of ways, taxes throughout this country.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but how does that square with footnote 9 of Bruin that talks about exorbitant fees? That, you know, these are presumptively lawful licensing regimes, but of course, there's always the possibility that someone, that a government can abuse that power. And the example that the court gives is exorbitant fees or, you know, or an excessively long wait time. Well, why would they use the word exorbitant fees if they wanted to run a $5 licensing fee through step two Bruin analysis?
Well, because there were fees during the colonial era on all sorts of stuff, Your Honor. So what the courts are saying is, you know, you'd be able to go look at the colonial era, 1791. You know, there were taxes, there were fees for all sorts of things, including firearms. And, in all likelihood, governments were able to point to reasonable fees being assessed, you know, in the 17, during the colonial period and justify that regulation. Whereas a fee that was exorbitant, for example, there was a $1,000 tax in Saipan that was struck down by the trial court there, and that's that couldn't be justified through looking at the colonial period.
Is there any circuit court that agrees with your position? Wouldn't we be the first to, if we were to agree with you, would we be the first circuit to say, no matter how de minimis this type of regulation is on acquisition, it must go through a step two Bruin analysis? Wouldn't we be the first to announce that?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean,
what's an example of a different case?
Well, I think Ortega is a very good case for me, Your Honor.
Ortega, which one is the Ortega
case? It's the 7-day waiting period case, Your Honor.
The Tenth Circuit.
Yes, Tenth Circuit, Your Honor.
Tinkovich's opinion.
So what do you do about the second part of the Second Amendment that says, so the first part says the right to keep and bear arms, and then the next part says shall not be infringed, right? So doesn't it seems that many regulations, and perhaps regulations that the Supreme Court was discussing in footnote 9 of Bruin, are regulations that are not deemed an infringement. I mean, there's something that implicates a right under the Second Amendment is your position, then we go straight to the historical analysis without considering whether it's, to use the term Judge Sanchez used, de minimis. I mean, how does it become an infringement if
it can't be justified through our historical tradition test, Your Honor?
Well, maybe you have to get past the language of the Second Amendment first. It has to be an infringement before you then – the right has to be infringed before you then go to see if that can be justified by a historical analog. Right? If there's no infringement, then the Second Amendment is not infringed.
Well, I think definitionally if infringement has to be discussed based upon our nation's historical tradition of arms-bearing conduct.
Well, except for our, which is what I was asking your friend across the aisle about, our incidental burden idea, which is that if we identify a right and we decide that the burden on that right is incidental, we claim it not a violation. We claim it not infringement. Well, we do that across rights.
Well, in this situation, that would be because there were incidental burdens on arms-bearing conduct during the colonial period, Your Honor. Therefore, those incidental burdens would be easily justified.
But I understand why that's your answer. But if I look at these other areas of law that have talked about the incidental standard, they're not rooted in history when they analyze whether something is an incidental burden or not. They're rooted mostly in common sense.
Yes, Your Honor. But in the Supreme Court analysis in the Second Amendment law is somewhat unique in the history.
Your idea is that Bruin is just setting aside that whole principle that otherwise applies to constitutional rights.
Your Honor, Bruin made it very clear what we have to do in this situation. So, yes, we can't use common sense.
Except for saying repeatedly that certain things are presumptively valid. Or I guess they only use presumptively once, but then they all the other times they say we're not casting doubt on the validity of these things.
Again, because there were firearms regulations during the colonial era. It's a bit of a misnomer that there were none. And the Supreme Court is simply saying that that there are a host of firearms regulations from the colonial era that can be pointed to justify a number of firearms regulations, Your Honor. That's how we interpret that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We went over time, but I'll give you a couple minutes, 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bruin's footnote 9 made clear the court's intention to leave largely undisturbed those permitting regimes which do not require applicants to show an atypical need for armed self-defense. Those permitting...
It didn't make clear whether it was prong 1 or prong 2. That seems to be what we're struggling with.
Your Honor, I would say they did make clear that it was prong one, and the reason why I take that position is because there just simply aren't historical analogs for background checks and safety courses and mental health statuses.
No, I totally disagree with you. If you read my Jones versus Bond opinion, I gave a whole historical analysis of why safety checks are historically analogous. But let's set that debate aside.
So even if you do decide to reach step two, Your Honor, I would commend the historical analogs that we've offered already. That's docket 52-1. That was our post-Bruin brief, the supplemental brief that we offered that has a set of historical analogs that we'd say match our laws, the laws at issue here pretty well. We could also offer additional ones. I mean, there are a lot greater resources now than there were at the time that we offered that brief, and we have additional analogs that we could offer. We would say that if you think this is a Bruin Step 2 case, you really should remand to the district court for us to offer additional evidence. So, for example, you can look at Rahimi itself and the Chief Justice's discussion of surety laws then, in which he explicitly acknowledges that determination was a time-limited determination. It was a six-month period, the same way that our determination that somebody satisfies the background check and mental health status requirements is a term-limited determination here. Information does go stale, and so the permit validity period has that historical analog. We would also offer firearm proving laws under which, at the time of the founding, multiple states had laws that required a government inspector to look at every firearm that was manufactured and offer a little stamp on it to prove that it was safe. We would say that's very similar to the inspection law that we have offered here. The other thing we would say at Bruin Step 2 is to be very careful with the analysis that was offered in Rahimi, in which the Supreme Court gave instruction that when you're looking at how and why, there is some room for play in the joints for legislatures as long as there's a reasonable why, and the reasonable why can be offered with safety. The how that a legislature used, the how they go about satisfying that why, the safety rationale, is something that you should offer some deference to. And so, We think that this is a step one case, but to the extent that you believe it's a step two case, remand would be appropriate.
But we could still, I'm sorry, Chief. Go ahead. I assume you're saying, though, be appropriate, or do you think on the record before us we could uphold Hawaii's law on step two? Do we have to remand?
You could absolutely uphold Hawaii's law on step two. We have additional things to offer if you think that we couldn't get there. But, I would say that we've offered a Bruin step two brief. There is a step two set of analogs. And I think Judge Rushing is right that the Supreme Court has already said that all shall issue regimes are satisfactory under vertical stare decisis. The Supreme Court has made that assessment.
All right, thank you.
Just clarification. On the 30-day law, is that all guns or just handguns?
All gun permits have a validity period. We're talking about here just the permit validity period for handguns, which is 30 days.
And then the second provision is limited to those three types of scenarios. Is that
yes,
correct?
Your Honor. The vast majority of guns that are sold in Hawaii are sold through licensed dealers, and so they would not be covered. It's just this very narrow set that have been that are subject to this inspection requirement.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you both, Ms. Sager, Mr. Beck, for your oral argument presentations here today. The case of Todd Yukitaki and David Kukurkawa versus Ann Lopez and the city in her official capacity as Attorney General of the State of Hawaii and the city and county of Honolulu is now submitted, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
All rise. For this session stands adjourned.